Okay, so people are settling down now. Strange thing is the monk giving talk after talk after talk. Sometimes I never know what I'm going to speak about next. There's a whole catalogue of experiences and understandings of Buddhism life. But as I mentioned before we started the meditation this evening, for the last, was it 8 days since beginning before Good Friday, I've been teaching a meditation retreat just a few kilometers south of here in the Redemptorist Monastery retreat house. And so when I teach a meditation retreat, I really get into it myself. So my mind is just full of the peace of meditation. So let's see how we go with the talk on what meditation is and how it works. Because sometimes as human beings in today's world, you get so much information, and so many people are telling you what to do and how to live your lives. And sometimes that's what we do here on a Friday night. Tell you or give you some advice on like how to solve the problems of your daily life. But sometimes that becomes endless. You solve one problem, another problem comes up. And very often people want to find the bigger picture, the deeper understanding, the answers to such things as the meaning of life and who you are. And one of the central things of Buddhism has always been meditation. For those of you who know anything of the history of Buddhism, it started by a person meditating under a tree. It was always there from the beginning, has always been a central part. And if there's any holy book in Buddhism, it is the holy book of meditation, which you read in your own heart, in the stillness of your mind, rather than any scripture. We always say the scriptures are secondary, let alone the commentaries about these scriptures, the ideas of monks and nuns such as myself. The experience must always be first. And so a lot of times that we try and encourage people who have come in contact with Buddhism, not just to listen and believe, but to listen, to follow and find out. On this beautiful path, the inner search for what happiness and peace truly is. Because there are too many arguments in this world, and too many differences of opinions, and people argue, and they just quarrel with each other. And sometimes that you're in the middle of this and think, who's right and who's wrong? Is it the Christians or Buddhists or Muslims or the atheists? And even the Buddhists, there's so many different sects of Buddhism, and even in one sect, there's so many different forms of Buddhists, and one monk says this, and another monk nun says that. Sometimes it can become so confusing. And anyway, is that what we're really here for? Or is it really here to find some peace of mind, some stillness? I remember just a few years ago, just going to book one of the tickets for some of my flights overseas to go and teach and serve other places. And at that time, our travel agent was Flight Center in Mirrabooka, just round the corner from here. But unfortunately, that was right in the middle of the shopping center. And like for a monk who lives a very simple life, shopping centers are like going into hell. Because you live so peacefully and so quietly, and you go into one of those places and you get these sounds and noises coming at you from all directions. And I used to really dislike that. We've changed the travel agent now, so it's just in West Perth, not in a shopping centre anymore. But every time I had to go in there, I remember standing at the doors and sort of getting my energy up and looking down and making a run for it. Head down, go. Because I found it so unpleasant to actually to have all these sights and the sounds and the smells. When you have a very peaceful, quiet mind, all these things are like putting hot water in a cool glass. It tends to make you uncomfortable. And sometimes I remember going into that shop once with another monk, and the other monk who was accompanying me just sat down on a chair, closed his eyes, and started meditating. And the person behind the counter stopped serving me. I looked at him, and she said, "I wish I could do that." And she really meant it. She saw that just a quiet, peaceful person in the middle of a frantic shopping center was like a promise of something which she knew was worthwhile, but she couldn't reach herself. And that promise of that peace inside, that stillness amongst the confusion of our life, is such a wonderful thing to experience. And this is why we meditate, to be able to feel a bit of peace and stillness in our life. Because that peace and stillness has two great benefits for you. Number one, it feels good. And number two, it gives you a perspective on what life is all about. All the wisdom which you hear from here on a Friday evening, I think many of you have found this out by now. It doesn't come from books. It comes from the experiences. And how does a monk know all these things? I was saying last night that some of the weird experiences I've had as a monk in my life here in Australia. Number one was going to a transport forum. It was in the Duxton Hotel run by Alana Matida when, you know, she was Minister of Transport at that time. And going there, because we had some trouble with clay trucks past our monastery, and actually going to the forum there. And while I was there, somehow or other, I stood out. And so a journalist approached me, asked me what I was doing there, and then interviewed me about shipping. Now, one thing, my character is I'm game to do anything. So I gave her the Buddhist idea of shipping. And of course, as usual, I was making it up as I went along. But they published that article, and it was a him who published this article, and I saw him about a year later when he came up to me and he said, "You wouldn't believe how popular that article was. It was syndicated to every shipping magazine almost in the world under the title Zen and the Art of Shipping." And all his fellow journalists came up to him, not all, but many, emailed him and said, "I don't know who that Ajahn Brahm is, but he certainly knows what he's talking about." And of course, I'd have no idea about shipping. But it wasn't that I struck lucky. There was something else going on there. And the second experience, I mentioned this a couple of nights ago in the retreat in North Perth. I think it was last night I mentioned this. Was when, that after a Friday night talk here in Nollamara, I went over to the studios of 6PR, because there's a few people I know in there, and they'd always invited me to come and do one of these evening shows, the talk shows. And so, you know, I'm game for anything. I said, okay, I'll give it a try. So I went in there just, you know, after finishing here, and getting to the studio, because, you know, you finish here about 9:30, 9:45, or, no, I made sure it was 9:30, so I got to the studios in the end of Haste Street. Yeah, I think it's Hay Street, in East Perth anyway, and got up there into the studios, and because I was, you know, pretty late, and I got straight into the studio, headphones on in front of the microphone, and then sort of they introduced me to the other people in the show. And there was a lady sitting next to me, and she said, "This is Dr. Gabriel Morrissey, who is the most prominent sexologist in Australia, who writes many books about sex." So it was only then when I asked, "What show is this?" And it was a show on adult themes. And so for the next two hours, I was in a ridiculous situation of a Buddhist monk who's been celibate for 33 years, so long I've been a monk, answering personal questions on your sexual performance. And I did very well. Because after half an hour, it's a 2-hour show, and they had breaks for sort of, you know, music and adverts. And after half an hour, all the questions, because when you do a phone call, apparently, on his radio station, say, "I have a question for, you know, Gabriel Morrissey, Dr. Morrissey." And on this show, because I don't know why, they couldn't get their tongue around Ajahn Brahm, on that show, they called me Mr. Monk. So it's a good bit of fun and games. And so had all these callers coming in. We got a question for Mr. Monk. We got another question for Mr. Monk. And I was handling all the questions. And this sexologist, who was supposed to be the biggest expert in Australia, was being completely outwitted by a celibate Buddhist monk. Now that's, again, one of those other true stories. And how on earth can a monk know about such things? Now, why is it that often people come up to the monks and to Sister Wayama talking about their marriage problems? Now think about it. What do I know about marriage? I've been a monk for 33 years. But people come and ask those questions and they get great answers. Where is all that wisdom coming from? Now, where that wisdom coming from? Why? You can talk about shipping and it makes sense. You can talk about sex and people listen and think, wow, that's interesting. It's because you have such still mind, you can see much deeper than other people. It's in that stillness that you see very clearly. You see the nature of your mind and other people's minds. This is the power of deep meditation, the still seeing. Which is why that this is one's authority to sit up here and teach the Dharma every Friday evening. It's not what I've learned. It's not any degrees which I have got. It's all the power of the still mind. Because what happens in meditation is the mind gets so tranquil that an interesting process happens. And this is the process of the empowering of mindfulness. Sometimes we have an idea in Buddhism about awareness, mindfulness, being alert. But how alert, how mindful are you? Sometimes you go around in a fog. But if you've always been in that fog, you take that for the bright sunshine of life. But what happens when you learn how to meditate properly? The mind becomes very still. And there's a process happens. The process is the energy of your mind, of your inner being, is no longer wasted on fruitless thinking and controlling and managing and complaining and all this struggling and striving which occupy most of our lives. Instead, as I said in the beginning of the meditation, it's as if we've been going on a long journey and we're so tired because we've been walking and travelling incessantly, always going to the next thing. And now we find a bench or a seat, and it does not need to be a comfortable bench. A simple stone slab might be enough. And we put down all our baggage and we sit down and rest for a few moments. And when we rest from our journey through time, through life, going someplace, getting somewhere, always going to the next thing, when we stop, what a relief. And the longer we stop, the more we recover. The more the energies start to build up, the natural energy of our mind returns, and the mind becomes energized. And that energy, when it builds up, becomes powerful mindfulness and alertness, which sometimes surprises you. When that mindfulness gets strong, life becomes more beautiful, more interesting, more delightful. One of the first times I realized this in my practice of meditation was the very first meditation retreat which I participated in. I was still a student, only 19 years of age, and a few of us hired a boarding house, about two or three boarding houses, in Cambridge. It's amazing when you've got good meditation. It was in Bateman Street, in Cambridge. That's maybe 39 years ago. I haven't thought of that name for such a long time. It's amazing when you meditate, your memory gets incredibly strong. You remember details a long time ago, clearly. In those boarding houses of Bateman Street, we meditated for 9 days. But before I went on that boarding house retreat, I did it with some trepidation, because I liked my food. And I knew as a fact, already the cooks in England were somewhere in the bottom of the league of European cuisine. Apparently, cooking in UK has improved since those years. But the English were not known for their cooking. Now, at the bottom of the pile of cooks were those who worked in boarding houses for poor students, who couldn't afford to complain. And I knew from experience that these cooks would usually every evening cook a 3-course meal. Stodge, stodge, and stodge. Doesn't matter what vegetable it was boiled so long it tasted the same. And if you know England in those years, you would know what I'm talking about. So I thought, I'm going to have a terrible time in this retreat with food. It's just going to be really awful. But I was surprised. During that period of retreat, every evening the food was delicious. It was very tasty. At the time, I thought I just must be lucky. My good karmas meant we've got the best boarding house cook in the whole of England. Now I know much better. The food was just ordinary food. But because I was practicing meditation, because I was becoming still, my mind was increasing in energy. So much so that the small amount of taste which was left in there, I could pick up. And now I know for a fact that whenever you go on a retreat, the food always tastes better than normal. Doesn't matter who the cook is, because it's not the food or the cook, it's your mind. So what that means is those of you who learn to be still in your meditation and get more powerful mindfulness, when you go out for a meal one evening, you will enjoy it even more. So if ever you go to an expensive restaurant, always remember to meditate for 30 minutes beforehand, so you can get your money's worth. Now that's actually something which is true. You become more awake and alert and sensitive when the energies of your mind improve. And it's not just that the food tastes better, but your whole surroundings look more beautiful. There's a simile in meditation which I've gave overseas many times, but it's been a while since I gave it here on a Friday evening. It's a simile of Bodhinyana Monastery at Serpentine, where I live. Many of you have been there, and you know it's up on top of a hill 2 kilometers. For the first 9 years I was staying in that monastery, I'd always go up and down that hill in a car. But I remember on one occasion, it was early in the morning, a nice spring morning, I had the time. I told the driver to stop at the bottom of the hill I wanted to walk up. And that's what I did. I walked up that hill. But a strange thing happened going up that hill. I could not recognize my surroundings at all. The hillside looked completely different than anything I remembered. And it was so surprising I stopped. And I stopped and stared in bewilderment. Am I up the same hillside? Again it changed, and this time it became so beautiful that I stopped and enjoyed scenery which I never realized existed. And then I pondered what was going on. Why couldn't I recognize those surroundings? If you don't believe me, if you always go to your house in a car up and down that road, one day stop at the corner and walk to your house. and you too will see things you've never seen before. Because what happens, I figured out, when you're looking through the window of a speeding car, it may only be going 40 kilometers or 50 kilometers an hour, but if you're looking out through that window, the light does not have sufficient time to form a proper image on the back of your eye, before another image comes up, dislodges the old, and you have to attend to that, and then another image comes up. The details don't fully form, the colors aren't rich, because you have to keep moving on to the next image, moving on to the next image. When you slow down, which is what I was doing when I was walking, I started to see details which my senses couldn't pick up because it was going too fast. I saw rocks and trees and bushes which I never knew existed. But also, because I was going slower, the physical process of seeing the light forming through the chemical reaction of light on the back of your eye, the colors became richer. Literally, the greens became brighter. And when I stopped and stood still, it was only then that my eyes had all the time they needed to form the full picture with all its detail. And you can see all the lichen on the rocks, and you can see the texture of the rocks, the different shades of grey, the different grasses, bushes, trees, everything. My goodness, it was so beautiful. Because even the texture of the tree was now fully formed, and the colours were bright. Looking at the same tree through the window of a speeding car, the colours were washed out. And like pastel, like you have a bright coloured t-shirt and you've been washing it so many times, all the colour is gone and it's sort of pastel and dull. But when I stopped, the colours were bright and brilliant. And that's what made it so incredibly beautiful. Simply because I'd slowed down. And my senses had time to see. And my mind had time to know. In that stillness, my mind had energized. And I could see more of what was going on. And it was far more beautiful. So also, what happens if you send your husband to learn meditation? When he goes back home, he thinks his wife looks far more beautiful than she was before. Because you can see more beauty. All that wonderful stuff which was in the husband and wife all along, which you were going too fast to notice, now it's there. My goodness, darling, have you had a makeover since I've been on retreat? No. I just have made over my mind so I can see more and appreciate more. Now that simile actually is very, very profound, because this is what we mean by waking up. We strengthen our mind. So actually, when you start to meditate, remember it's all about stillness. Allowing things to stop and be still. And in the stillness, you build up energy. And in that energy build-up, you see more clearly. The mindfulness increases in its strength, which means you can perceive more deeply than other people. But also, as you perceive more deeply, you can perceive more happily as well. Meditators become happier people. When I was in Hong Kong a couple of weeks ago, also teaching meditation, was the French monk who was the subject of Professor Davidson's experiments in the University of Wisconsin, who was doing functional magnetic resonance scans of many people to find out who was the happiest people. And this monk, a meditator, I think Michel Foucault, Michel Ricard. He came out top of the scale. So he goes around now the happiest person in the world. It's a nice acronym, isn't it? Nice thing to be known as. And that's not a subjective feeling. He was scanned and found out, yeah, he really was happy, simply because of his meditation. Now you know why the energies go up. Do you ever feel tired? Do you ever feel you're dragging yourself through life? Life is such a burden because you're not still enough. You don't know how to recharge those energies. So when you have a strong mind, you have an energetic mind, a happy mind, you can do things and you can also see very deeply what's going on. There's another thing I've been teaching during our retreat over in North Perth, because other strange things happen when you start being still. A few years ago, a person in the retreat in North Perth came up to me and said she had a very strange experience during her meditation. She was getting quite still, but her back became very hot. It was like on fire, not unpleasantly so, not painfully, but like an inflammation was occurring there, and she did not know why. So she came and saw me afterwards and said, "What's going on?" I was meditating then, it suddenly got really warm and hot. So I asked her, "When did you have your accident?" And she looked at me. I said, "Brahm, you read my mind. I had a car accident a few years ago." "Yes, and you injured your back and shoulders." "Yes, how do you know?" "Look, it's not psychic powers. It's just you told me because this is what happens." Strange thing about the body is that it has its own innate healing processes. The trouble is we get in the way too often. Because of our stress, the way that stress works, we block things from occurring. We don't give them time. We don't actually relax the body long enough. The energy flows to go to where they're needed. In Indian medicine, in the time of the Buddha, they called it winds which have to flow through your body. Energy flows. And you all probably know the Chinese version of that, the qi energy going through your body. And sicknesses are interpreted as blockages in the energy flows through your body. And I remember reading an article in a Buddhist magazine some years ago where they had a traditional Tibetan doctor who had only just came over from Tibet as a refugee, but he was one of the famous doctors in Tibet. Couldn't speak any English, or I don't think he could even read. And they took him into a hospital in the US just to test him out. They showed him patients and asked him to diagnose what was wrong with them. And I think he tested the pulses like in Chinese medicine. I think, I don't know, is it 9 pulses, I think? I forget how many it is now. He checked it, all his pulses. And then straight away he said, that guy's got a blockage around his heart region. He had congested arteries around his heart. He was going to do a bypass soon. That was one example I remember. This guy got it straight away. But the way he interpreted it was like blockages in energy flows. The doctors in the US, using the scan, showed there was a blocked arteries close to his heart. Exactly the same. You could see the similarities there. So there's a lot of truth in this idea of the blockages of energy through your body. And what happens when you really relax? Those blockages are released. When you get out of the way, the body knows what to do. In fact, it knows what to do much better than you do. And so she was getting out of the way, relaxing, getting into her mind. The body really relaxed, and the energy started to flow to where they were needed. Her back injury hadn't fully healed, so all this energy came up that she felt really hot, and afterwards she felt so good. This is what the health benefits of meditation are. But you can't force it. You have to relax and let go and allow things to happen. Our problem is, and the reason why people can't get to such deep stages of meditation is because they are control freaks. And in meditation, no control. For those of you who are Buddhists, you should know that there are 2 types of meditation being taught. And don't think that is vipassana and samatha. That is wrong. They are the same. Just to go on a sideline here, samatha meditation means calm. Vipassana means insight. Once upon a time, Mrs. Samatha, that means calm, and her husband, Mr. Insight, Mr. Vipassana, decided to go on a walk up a hill. Mrs. Samatha, Mrs. Calm, went up to the top of the hill because it was so peaceful on top of that hill. And Mr. Vipassana, her husband, Mr. Insight, he went up there because he had a beautiful view on top of the hill. Now, they both went up there for different reasons. But when Mr. Samatha got up to the top of the hill, Mr. or Mrs., yeah, you all know what I mean. I had a sex change halfway up the hill, probably. But when Mrs. Samatha, go right way, Mrs. Samatha, Mrs. Peace got to the top of the hill, oh, she enjoyed the peace. It was so calm on top of the hill, away from the town and the city and the roads. But it was not only calm up there, she saw the view as well. And when Mr. Vipassana, Mr. Insight, when he got to the top of the hill, oh, he enjoyed the view because that's what he went up there for, but he also experienced a beautiful peace. Because on the top of the hill, the peace and the view always coexist. There is no difference between those two types of meditation. So the two types of meditation in Buddhism, we call those Second Noble Truth Meditation and Third Noble Truth Meditation. For those of you who don't know basic Buddhism, the Four Noble Truths, Second Noble Truth is desire leads to suffering. The Third Noble Truth is letting go leads to enlightenment, ultimate peace. So those are the two types of meditation. Desiring, wanting, wanting, wanting. That leads to suffering. So whenever you meditate and you want something, you are going to suffer. You are going to get frustrated. You are going to get restless. You'll never find peace through wanting things. The other type of meditation, Third Noble Truth Meditation, is letting go. Leads to nibbana, peace. So when we do meditation, remember there's two types of meditation. Wanting, wanting, wanting. And letting go, letting go, letting go. So if you aren't going to be still, you have to do Third Noble Truth Meditation. Shh. Stop doing anything. Stop controlling. Have you ever heard the explanation of compassion in this retreat, in this place here? The usual way I explain compassion or loving kindness is saying the door of my heart is open no matter who you are, no matter what you've ever done. My love for you is unconditional. That's also letting go meditation. This moment, whatever it is, pleasant, unpleasant, restless, sleepy, the door of my heart is open to this moment, unconditionally, no matter what you are. Compassion and letting go are exactly the same things. Compassion is when we don't control the object of our kindness. If you really love your partner, you will never try to control them. You love them for who they are. Your love gives them freedom. If you love yourself with the wise compassion of loving kindness, you don't love yourself and say, I'm hopeless, I should be better. I should be a better parent, a better mother, a better father, a better partner, a better nurse, a better monk. Loving kindness is saying to yourself, the door of my heart is open to me, no matter what I've ever done, no matter who I am. Come in. You make peace with yourself. And that's exactly what you do in meditation. It doesn't matter what you're aware of right now, what's happening to you. You say, the door of my heart is open to this moment, to my mind, to my body, to my consciousness. Unconditionally, whoever you are, whatever's happening, come in. You make peace with your mind, with your heart. That's how you meditate. You don't meditate trying to get somewhere, trying to be different. That just is another striving, That's why it makes you so tense. Some people meditate and they go out more angry than when they came in, because they're not meditating correctly. If you meditate properly, a letting go, a calmness, a kindness, all those problems which were once in the mind tend to disappear and vanish. In the book which I wrote, Opening the Door of the Heart, is a wonderful story which applies to life and meditation. And it actually comes from the word of the Buddha himself. In some of the scriptures called Udana, he taught the story, the well-known story of the anger-eating demon. The story begins in a palace in a land a long time ago. And in that palace, the emperor was away on some other business. And while he was away, this monster came into the palace. This demon, who looked so ugly and so terrifying that all the soldiers and the guards froze in fear, which allowed that monster to stride right through the palace and enter the throne room and sit on the emperor's chair. At which point, the guards and the soldiers came to their senses, and they shouted, "Get out of there! Who do you think you are? It's the emperor's chair. Get out!" And at those few unkind words, that monster, that demon, grew an inch bigger, more ugly, and the stench coming off him got worse, and so did the monster's language. They got out their swords and clubs, and they threatened all sorts of horrendous injury to that monster if he didn't get out. They threatened and bullied and tried to scare him, but every unkind word, every unkind deed or unkind thought, that monster just grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, more offensive. This had been going on a long time when the emperor came back. And when he came back and walked into his palace, this demon was huge, taking up half of the hall. And he was so ugly. If you think you've seen something frightening in aliens, you've never seen anything as frightening as that demon. And he smelt so bad, as I wrote in my book, his stench would even make a maggot throw up. And his language, the language was worse than you would hear on a Saturday night in Fremantle after the Dockers lost to the Eagles. Terrible language. Now, the reason this guy was the emperor was because he was smart. He knew what to do. As soon as he saw that demon, he said, "Welcome. Thank you so much for coming here. Oh, it's been such a long time since we've enjoyed a visit by you, monster. Has anyone got you anything to drink yet? Would you like a cup of tea? We have English breakfast. We have Dilma straight from Sri Lanka. Or would you like peppermint? It's good for your health." And at those few kind words, the demon grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. And then everybody got the message. So they asked him if he wanted something to eat. "Do you want a pizza? Monster size, of course. Would you like a foot massage?" It's very rare monsters get foot massage. And reflexology is just so nice. So they gave this monster a foot massage. And someone massaged the scales on the back of his neck with such a big head. No wonder he had his shoulder pain. And they were so kind to this monster. At every kind act, word or thought, the monster grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. And it took almost no time. And he was back to the size when he first came in. But did they stop there? No, they carried on with kindness until soon that monster was at a size when he first came, when he's so small that one more act of kindness and that monster disappeared completely. He vanished. The Buddha told that story. He never mentioned a pizza. I made that bit up. But he called that an anger-eating demon, which feeds on anger. The more anger and ill will you give it, the bigger and uglier and smellier it becomes. And what a great insight into many things of life that was. Because there are so many anger-eating demons in this world. Sometimes when your husband comes home from work, he's an anger-eating demon. You look, you get angry at him. And he gets an inch bigger. He certainly gets uglier. And it gets worse in his language. Anger-eating demons. But the anger-eating demon I'm talking about here is your state of mind. How often is it that you are with yourself and you say, I don't like this, get out of here, you don't belong? Because it's ugly, smelly, offensive, whatever, you don't like it? So many of the states of mind we live with are anger-eating demons. The more we don't like them, the worse they get. So, the way of meditation, whatever you're looking at, whatever your experience, you say, welcome. Thank you for coming to visit me. Is there anything I can do for you? And that act of kindness will make the demon of depression, the demon of lack of self-esteem, the demon of fear, the demon of even anger itself, get less and less and less and less. And with that kindness, all those demons which plague human beings in our time vanish completely away. We feed it kindness, acceptance. We make peace with these things, not war. That's what we call Third Noble Truth meditation. Making peace, not war, with our own mind. How many people are aggressive, even violent, not to their body, but to the body as well, but also to their mind? The violence to the body is not giving yourself enough rest, not sleeping enough, not taking time out. How hard do we work? And with the weekend, we push ourselves even harder. That's called doing violence to your body. You only have to go to Charlie Gardner's to see how many people are sick in cancer wards, how many people have heart problems, let alone all these other sicknesses which seem to plague our modern world. Where do they come from? From violence to our body, pushing it too hard. But more than that, all the mental difficulties which people have in our modern world, which fill the rooms of psychologists and psychiatrists, are all come from violence to the mind. You've been so cruel to yourself, instead of being kind to the mental states which come from time to time, until those demons get so big they take up more than half of your mind. Instead you say, welcome, be kind, be gentle, make peace, and the demon grows smaller and smaller and smaller. So whenever you're meditating, to be able to get peace of mind, you can't get peace of mind by making war. As Mr. Bush has found out, which everyone has found out, there's no peace through war. There's this old saying, which part of a poem by William Blake. When I read this, I always remembered it, because it was so true. I think William Blake was in the, 17th century, 16 or 1700, so about 200 or 300 years ago, when he said, vengeance to the tyrant fled, and caught the tyrant in his bed, and slew the wicked tyrant's head, and became a tyrant in his stead. So obvious that by slaying the tyrant, you become the tyrant. By making war, You never get peace. You just make more war. The same with your mind. Why do we make war with our mind instead of making peace? Sometimes I call meditation the house of peace. And a house, especially here in Perth, is made of bricks. And if you ever watch a builder or the bricklayer, they lay every brick one by one in sequence. And then you get your house. And it's the same as a house of peace meditation. Meditation is made by so many moments of peace, laid one after the other after the other. You make peace with every moment. And the next moment you make peace with it. With compassion and kindness and gentleness and non-aggression, you accept this moment for what it is. You love this moment with a compassion and care. I mention that I'm a monk, so I don't know about kids. But every now and again someone brings their babies to our monastery for blessing. And sometimes I even have to hold them. And sometimes they just pooed in their nappies and stink. And when I give them back, I think, oh, what a wonderful life it is being a monk. And to me, it's one of those weird and strange things which I can never understand. How can anyone love such a stinking, ugly, screaming baby like that? I'm being a man. But a mother just loves that kid and just stares at them and they just don't smell the poo. And they just, the screams which will drive me crazy. Oh, isn't it sweet? Isn't it lovely? It's amazing what you can love. And if a mother can love that, surely you can love your mind. Sure, your mind goes crazy, but it doesn't scream as much as a baby. Well, sometimes it does, but if you can love the baby, you surely love your mind when it's screaming, when it poos all over the place. What I'm saying is that the compassion and kindness is amazing what you can accept and make peace with. And if you can make peace with every moment, not making war, not trying to make it different, not trying to get out of this or get rid of it or go somewhere else, but just to make peace, you find you have this amazing peace built up. You are building the house of peace, the great stillness of the mind. You make that by making peace in every moment. That's how we meditate. And by making peace, the peace builds. Peace is what leads to stillness. When you're at peace, you can rest. Sure, there's much of the journey to be done, but not now. Instead of looking at what needs to be done, you look back on what has been done. And that gives you permission to be at peace. Sometimes I tell people when they go home on a Friday night after listening to a Dhamma talk for so long and you go home late, you've been working all day, and you look at all the dirty dishes in the sink in your kitchen, and you think, oh no, do I have to wash those up? My advice to you is look at all the clean dishes on the shelves. And if there's more clean dishes than dirty dishes, you're ahead, so go to bed. Don't look at the dishes which need to be cleaned. Look at the dishes which have been cleaned. Give yourself permission to take a break. Otherwise, whenever will all the dishes be clean? Whenever will all the work be done? Whenever will you be able to rest in peace? You get it? Where do people rest in peace in our world? In the cemeteries, yes. So don't wait till then. So grant yourselves these moments of peace. Make peace. It's important. And a great thing happens when you make peace with every moment. The mindfulness builds up. Because of peace, because you're rest, because you're still, energy starts to rise. Your food starts to taste better. Your wife looks a lot more beautiful. Life looks more happy. But more than that, you can see deeply into things. You can appreciate things more. Do you appreciate life? Really? Does it give you fun in every moment? Too often we're racing around. Life is not enjoyable anymore. It's not fun. It hasn't got the sort of beauty, the oomph to it. If you really go into that dullness, that's called depression, when life is just so grey. With mindfulness, depression disappears. Can't happen. You're just so bright and bubbly. You remember all these jokes, and I said I was going to tell a joke today. This is put in, it's completely out of context, but who cares? Guy goes to the doctor. And the doctor said, "Sorry, sir, you got terminal cancer." "Oh, gee, that's bad news." But the doctor says, "But I found another disease you have as well. You've also got Alzheimer's disease." "Alzheimer's? Oh, that's not so bad. At least I haven't got cancer." It's one of those jokes where the smart people laugh first, and then eventually everybody else gets it. But anyhow, you're bubbly, you have fun in life, simply because you've got more energy. But also you start to see deeper. So all that wisdom, then you too can go on radio shows and talk about things you've got no idea what you're talking about. And actually come across and it's really deep what you're saying. You tend to see more. And the whole idea of like wisdom teachings like Buddhism is learning how to see the truth for yourself. What is this life all about? What is the nature of human beings? Find out for yourself, for goodness sake. And the Buddha went so deep in this meditation. His mindfulness got so strong and so blissful. You really start to see very, very deeply into the nature of life and the nature of how to live your life, about the importance of giving yourself a break, but also how you can work hard as well. It's the importance of not being so negative about life. Training, actually, the importance of learning how to help people by never focusing on yourself, never focusing on other people, but focusing on what's between us all. A great little insight. In a relationship, in a family, it's not about you. It's not about your partner. It's not about your kids. It's about us. In a community, it's not about the monks. It's not about the nuns. It's not about the lay people. I can't exist without you. You can't exist without me. It's always about us. Personalities disappear, and relationships become prominent. Wouldn't it be wonderful if politicians realized that? It's not about personal power. It's about working together, for goodness sake. We're all in this together. We have to all row in the same direction. When people get married, I tell them that before you get married, you were a two-legged animal called a man. You were a two-legged animal called a woman. Now you're married, you're joined together, you're elephant. With four legs. And the important thing about elephant with four legs, doesn't matter which is the back legs and the front legs, as long as they all go in the same direction. If the front legs of an elephant go in one direction and the back legs of the elephant go in another direction, what happens to the elephant? Falls down. And if elephants fall down, it's very hard for an elephant to get up. It's so fat and heavy. So it's all about learning how to pull together, work together. When you understand that, opening the mind and becoming awake, it's very easy, to find common ground with the Christians and Muslims and other people and to learn how to work together. Because the arguments in life, the differences of opinion and putting other people down, if you put someone else down, you're putting yourself down. When you're arguing, you're creating a conflict, not just in that person, but in you as well. I always used to say, when you get angry at someone else and you shout at them, it's like throwing a coal at somebody, a hot coal, hoping you're going to hit them. But you always burn your own hand. Sometimes you hit them, sometimes you miss them, but you always hurt yourself whenever you get angry. So a lot of the way we relate in this world is just, to me, stupidity. We're just not seeing clearly. We're not awake enough. Our mindfulness isn't strong enough. When you wake up and become strong in the mindfulness, you see more deeply. Why do I want to hurt that person I married? It doesn't make any sense. Because I'm hurting me. I'm hurting us. I'm hurting the kids. I'm hurting society. I'm hurting everybody. I'm just creating hurt, that's all. Why do we create so much hurt in this world? Because of stupidity. That's why when someone asked me years ago, is there such a thing as evil in Buddhism? There's no such thing as evil in Buddhism, it's just stupidity. People being dull and not seeing clearly. And because of that, there's always a solution. The solution to evil or stupidity is not destroying the evil or stupid people or putting them away in sort of prisons and executing them. The solution is opening their eyes, letting them see clearly. That's what we do here. Not through listening and learning and having more ideas and concepts, but through waking up, through meditation, so we have this wonderful mindfulness. So many of the problems are solved. We see clearly. Which is why we've got to finish soon. You know what the word Buddha means? The Buddha of Buddhism? It doesn't mean the enlightened one, as many of the monks in my monastery pointed out. It actually comes from an old Sanskrit Pali word called Bhujati, which means the awakened one. Just someone who's woken up. Doesn't mean you just got out of bed in the morning. It means that you've got strong mindfulness. You see things clearly. And it's through seeing those things clearly that we solve the problems in ourselves, the problems in our life, the problems in sex, and the problems in shipping. That's why when you wake up, you can answer all those problems. And it's amazing just how effective you are. I'm finishing the talk now, but on Sunday, I'm flying to London. You know what I'm flying there for? Because the next wheeze, which I've got myself into, is actually teaching at a human resources conference. So now I'm not teaching about sex, not teaching about shipping. Now I'm teaching about business. And I'm giving a masterclass in this. They invited me all the way from Perth, pay my air tickets, give me a hotel room, so I can teach CEOs and managing directors on how to run their companies. And I'm a Buddhist monk who haven't got any money, no business experience. And they've selected for me for this. They've gone around and found, yeah, we want this guy. Why? Because you've woken up. And when you've woken up, you can teach anything to anyone at any time. And that's one of the great funs of being a monk. So, may you too one day wake up with meditation and mindfulness and have a happy life and go all over the world at somebody else's expense. Have a great time. Thank you very much. Okay, now, are there any questions about this evening's talk? I'm waking up. And I'm glad that no one went to sleep during this talk. No? Going. Okay, gone, okay.
Sankang Namami.